This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. For fans of figure skating, the enduring image of the Winter Games in Torino may be the elegance, composure, and confidence of Shizuka Arakawa as she completed her free skate program without a mistake. Once Michelle Kwan had withdrawn from these Olympics, U.S. fans hoped that Sasha Cohen would win gold in what many people consider the jewel of the Games. But though she led after the short program, Cohen slipped twice during her free program, turning in a silver medal performance that she apparently felt would be rewarded less generously than it was.
I definitely didn't think I was going to get any medal when I finished skating, so it was a nice surprise.
Speaking of surprises, snowboarding fans aren't likely to forget the Hurricane. The unlikely, unprecedented combination of twists and flips U.S. snowboarder Jarrett Peterson managed while tumbling toward the snow from five stories up. For Peterson, the achievement overshadowed the awkward landing that pushed him out of medal contention.
I'm happy. I obviously didn't come here to end up seventh place, but I came out here to do the Hurricane, and I did the Hurricane.
Among the more bizarre developments at these games was the raid staged by Italian authorities on the residents of the Austrian biathletes and cross-country skiers. The authorities had been tipped off to the presence in Torino of Walter Meyer, the former Austrian coach who'd been banned from the games by the International Olympic Committee for his involvement in blood doping 4 years ago. In the course of fleeing back to Austria, Meyer slammed his car into a police vehicle and injured an officer, then claimed he was suicidal and checked himself into a mental institution. Yesterday, Arne Lundqvist, chairman of the International Olympic Committee's Medical Commission, announced that the tests on 10 Austrian athletes had not established that blood doping had occurred.
What we wish to rule out, let me put it that way, is that people may have been using small dosages of erythropoietin on the day or a few days before a particular competition. That would have been detectable in the urine, but we did not detect anything like that.
The tests were also negative for steroids and stimulants. The police raid did turn up large quantities of the anti-asthma drug salbutamol. 95% of the Austrian athletes in the residence claimed they were asthmatic and required the medication, which is banned by the IOC except when there are therapeutic use exemptions. Those bizarre developments aside, the games provided numerous brilliant performances, some of which came at the perfect time. Veteran skier Michaela Dorfmeister of Germany won two gold medals. She had announced before the games that she planned to retire after the competition. The Swedish women's hockey team played Canada in the final, becoming the first team other than the U.S. ever to achieve that distinction. And if some of the more energetically promoted U.S. athletes, like the U.S. hockey players of both genders, were disappointed, Americans determined to cheer only for their countrymen could celebrate the upset victory of the U.S. men's curling team over Britain yesterday afternoon, 8-6. Led by pizzeria owner Pete Fenson, the U.S. team thus won the nation's first ever curling medal, a bronze. Even more successful during yesterday's competition was Julia Mancuso, known for wearing a tiara on the ski slopes. Mancuso won gold in the giant slalom, after which she thrust her fists into the air and kissed one ski, which is exactly what she did earlier this week after more disappointing runs that did not result in medals. It must have made some viewers wonder whether it was ultimately more important for athletes like Julia Mancuso to look cool than to win. A question I put to Paul Swangard, the managing director of the Warsaw Sports Marketing Center at the University of Oregon.
Well, it depends on what their motives are. The fact of the matter for these Olympic athletes is this is a once every 4 year stage, and if they would like to leverage this opportunity to be exposed to such a mainstream American audience, not only do you have to compete well, but you have to compete with a little bit of flair, because that flair is what marketers will tend to focus on once the games are over.
So you have to compete memorably.
Yeah, I think it'd be one thing to just be a good athlete, and you know, even if you end up on the Olympic gold medal stand, you know, if there's not a personality behind it from a marketing standpoint, that is really what the companies are looking to tap into. Is there something about you, that it factor, that X factor, mm-hmm. whatever factor you want to call it, is something that resonates with the public, makes you memorable. You know, Shaun White didn't have to win a gold medal to be known as the tomato-haired, you know, snowboarder.
The flying tomato.
Exactly. And whether Heinz is already called asking for, him to be plastered on cans of tomato sauce, I don't know. But it's that kind of exigence, you know, that's the thing you have to covet as an athlete.
Nobody is likely to forget another American who possibly put more emphasis on looking cool than she did on winning, at least at one crucial moment, and that's Lindsay Jacobellis, who lost the gold medal to some last-minute hot-dogging. She's been hammered by sports columnists around the globe, but I'm wondering if her mistake and then her nonchalant response to winning silver rather than gold will make her a hero among the X Games generation.
Well, I think you hit on a key point, which is this isn't necessarily always about being, you know, the family face to the mainstream consumer base. That for that sport, maybe the bigger upside for them is being hip and cool and relevant to a younger generation that, quite honestly, in most cases have been watching those events and then going off and watching Simon, Paula, and Randy, you know, judge bad singing in American Idol. So I think, you know, in talking to some of the sponsors of the Olympics already, you know, her, not only the way she handled herself, but the way in which, you know, she competed is something that probably won't hurt her long term, that she will still be somebody looked at as being, if I have a brand that's trying to reach that type of consumer base, I probably could utilize her in some way to make me hip and cool to that generation.
It's a curious shift for snowboarding, the sport that you mentioned, because until fairly recently, snowboarders were very proud of not being mainstream, saying, hey, this isn't about corporate America. This is about something else entirely, freedom, being ourselves, self-expression.
Funny how capitalism works, doesn't it? you know, this idea that, and I think we saw it in skateboarding as well, even though a lot of people would say Tony Hawk, you know, was a sellout for going mainstream and developing video games and his own line of boards and not being true to the sport. And it goes back to what I said earlier, and no one here is telling any of these kids they have to go out and endorse a line of snowboards or snowboard equipment, but at the same time, if they want to, then they have to be, you know, willing to understand the role they play of being a brand, the role they play of trying to grow the market and who they're really talking to make that business opportunity come to life.
You mentioned American Idol, and the Winter Olympics have been thoroughly trounced in the ratings by our country's other favorite amateur competition, that being American Idol. Even against the highly popular women's figure skating short program on Tuesday night, American Idol still won by nearly 20 percentage points. What is going on here?
Well, I think it's one of the more fascinating discussions and one that we've you know, tried to use in our classrooms the last couple of weeks. I mean, they started, American Idol did, on a real high in early February where they doubled the ratings of the Grammy Awards, which is professional musicians who actually make money at it.
And are good.
Couldn't even draw, you know, half the audience of people who, you know, had just come off the street to sing, you know, the overplayed hits of the 80s. And I think in what we've learned over the last couple of weeks is twofold. One is that that sports as a programming vehicle across a number of different sports, not just the Olympics, has seen their ratings go down over the last couple of years. But it also speaks to how, if you strip away the fact that it's a music competition for a moment and you compare the storylines of a reality TV show like American Idol and a sports competition like the Olympics, it's really almost the same thing. I mean, we're talking about, for the most part, a large group of unknowns for which one will become the next great American hero. You look at the other reality TV shows like Dancing with the Stars or Skating with the Stars or Playing Highlight with the Stars. I mean, it's really a you know, an effort to tap into the notion of competition, even though it's a managed, unscripted drama in terms of some control over those types of things. This is servicing, in many respects, what sports had always serviced to the American television consumer, and it's now not surprising then that a potentially more entertaining version of the same storyline in the version of American Idol, you know, is going toe-to-toe with something that, you know, NBC paid more than $600 million to televise for 16 days.
How much of NBC's ratings troubles are due to the fact that many of the athletes who were highly promoted before the games, I'm thinking now of Michelle Kwan, Vonetta Flowers, and Bodie Miller, have not turned out to be the stars of the Olympics?
I think that's a dimension to it. The other reality to this is that, you know, the time shifting of the competition, we're living in a day and age where most consumers know what has happened at the Olympic Games before they sit down in front of their television. And if they're not convinced there's a compelling story to watch, they're not going to watch it. And that would have helped, certainly, if the names you mentioned would have, lived up to their pregame hype.
NBC's ratings for the Olympics are down, I'm told, as much as 50% from the Salt Lake Games 4 years ago. And it's not just American Idol giving the network a run for its money. NBC insists they won't lose money on the Games, but should executives begin to reconsider how much to pay for exclusive rights to air the Olympics?
Well, I think, you know, you could certainly question whether, you know, is there more value in the Winter Games versus the Summer Games, or I'll pay more for games that are located in the North American region as opposed to ones that will be in Europe and face a major time shifting. You know, the other thing we've witnessed is the proliferation of platforms that the Olympic coverage is being distributed on. So it may be that we're seeing ratings go down on the television platform and maybe a little less of a degradation on cable platforms for NBC. But, you know, this certainly is going to be the games that we witness the shift to an online world, which will create enormously new and interesting opportunities for broadcasters that own the rights to the content and really change, I think, the discussion around how we deliver content in the future. I mean, you put out, you know, what will the world look like in 2010 in terms of how I might be able to receive television-like content. You know, it could very well be that the most lucrative part of NBC's television coverage is going to be live coverage of events in real time, broadcast on iPods, 3G wireless cell phones, and a device to be named later.
Paul Swangard is the managing director of the Warsaw Sports Marketing Center at the University of Oregon. Paul, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Yeah, appreciate it.
It's 19 minutes past the... I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, a conversation with the authors of the Baseball Uncyclopedia, a highly opinionated, myth-busting guide to the great American game. But first, Major League spring training camps are currently bustling with veterans and greenhorns trying to land spots on big league rosters. Pitcher Kyle Denny, who reported last week to the Washington Nationals camp in Vieira, Florida, is among the rookies. His young baseball career has been marked by circumstances freakish and sometimes dangerous to boot. Only a Game's Greg Eklund caught up with Kyle Denny during the offseason, and he has this report.
On an unusually warm January afternoon in Owosso, Oklahoma, the high school baseball team held its workout on the baseball diamond. In addition to the uncharacteristically warm weather, there was another interloper.
Freshman, down here!
I won't hear you, man.
7-year baseball professional Kyle Denny stretches and throws to one of the coaches before practice starts, all the while chatting with the high schoolers like he's one of the guys. With his goatee and youthful look, he fits right in with members of the Owosso Rams, many of whom are 10 years his junior. But Denny's 26 years old now and preparing for spring training with the Washington Nationals. In 1999, Denny was drafted by the Cleveland Indians after pitching 2 years for the University of Oklahoma. In 6 years with the Indians, Denny moved up through the system before his first call-up to the majors on September 14, 2004. 2 years ago, his freakish experiences began. After his fourth and final start as a September call-up, Denny was shot in the leg while on the team bus shortly after it left Kansas City's Kauffman Stadium.
You hear the shot, but it wasn't like a loud, like you would think of a gunshot. It was like a firecracker. It was kind of going off and didn't think of hardly really anything of it. It didn't hurt. Good Lord was watching over me because how it went in the bus, I mean, it shouldn't have went straight. I mean, when it goes through metal, obviously, there's chances of it going any way, high, low, whatever. But it got me in the leg, and fortunately, it wasn't anywhere in the head area or the lung area or something like that.
Fortunately for Denny, the Indians rookies were in the process of being pranked. Unnamed veteran pranksters had replaced the rookies' clothes with various costumes. In Denny's case, it was a USC women's cheerleader's uniform. The humiliation Denny felt for having to wear the uniform of a cheerleader from a rival school was quickly forgotten when the bullet went through one of his accessories and into his leg.
It was a high-heel boot. It's a go-go boot that you see from time to time on the streets. You know, people say, you know, the boot saved me. Well, you know, I think the 2 inches of steel on the bus probably did a lot more slowing down the bullet than the boot did.
The case was never solved. Last year, Denny was back in the minors pitching for AAA Buffalo when misfortune struck again. On June 26th, his season ended after only 9 starts when he was struck in the face by a line drive off the bat of the Durham Bulls leadoff hitter.
I remember the ball being immediately in my face, not being able to move or anything. And Buffalo, actually, it's an afternoon game. When the sun hits the seats, it's kind of hard to see. There's a plated glass a little bit behind it, so the glare is kind of hard. And, you know, it's just one of those things. I threw it, and there it was. I tried not to let it hit me in the face, but fortunately it got me in the back of the head and kind of scrambled my head a little bit, scrambled my brains, and was pretty dizzy.
Denny was removed from the field on a stretcher and was rushed to a nearby hospital. He had suffered a cerebral contusion, a fractured skull, and a ruptured eardrum. Denny says he still experiences occasional dizzy spells, and he'll have to deal with the constant ringing in his ear for the rest of his life. Denny's arm is healthy, though, and that's what he hopes will get him back to the big leagues. Denny was on the mound again last fall pitching in Caribbean Winter League ball. Last month, he signed with the Nationals as a minor league free agent, with whom he hopes to catch on for the opening day roster.
Where I'm at, and even at lower levels, I mean, it's a game of adjustments and your own will and drive, because in the offseason, a lot of times there's not a lot of guys that you work out with, so you basically have to push yourself. And it's got to be a very much a self-motivating thing, because if you don't, somebody will pass you up. And that's one thing you don't. You don't want somebody to take your job in anything. And that's how I look at it, and I'm going after somebody else's job, and they have the same mindset I do.
Baseball is said to be a game of inches. In Denny's case, an inch higher could have changed his career and his life.
It's funny to think about it now, but obviously if it had been an inch up more, it could have been pretty serious.
For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Owosso, Oklahoma.
The Baseball Uncyclopedia, subtitled A Highly Opinionated Myth-Busting Guide to the Great American Game, is certainly that, unless you don't think baseball is still the great American game. Anyway, the co-authors, Michael Kuhn and Howard Bloom, probably had a lot more fun putting together their book than the editors of the actual Baseball Encyclopedia had compiling the material for that weighty volume. To test that theory, I welcome Michael Kuhn, who joins me on the line from Los Angeles. Michael, thanks for joining me.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And Howard Bloom is here with me in the studio. Howard, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. Great to be here, Bill.
So, Howard, should we start right in with the pro and con on the proposition that former Baltimore Orioles shortstop Cal Ripken is overrated?
Well, I, of course, believe that Cal Ripken should never even be allowed inside of the Hall of Fame. Cal Ripken was a .276 lifetime batter, and Cal Ripken did nothing but drag his team down by playing and not taking himself out of the lineup when he should have, just in the name of a record.
Okay, so Michael, do we move right along, or have you got something to say?
I'm ashamed to know, Howard. It is shameful that he's even a part of my life that I've written a book with this man who doesn't understand what a great ballplayer Cal Ripken was.
I should point out, in case it hasn't already become evident, that you guys did not write the entries in the Baseball Encyclopedia together. Each passage is followed by the initials of the man responsible. So, Michael, I want you to focus on another of your opinions. You maintain that, quote, every single one of us would trade some portion of our lives just to have had Drungo Hazewood's career. Why is that?
Now, when I say every single one of us, I mean every single one of us who would pick up a book like the Baseball Encyclopedia. There are people out there that wouldn't pick it up and that couldn't care less. I would say I'm one of possibly 8 people on this planet who even remember who Drungo Hazewood was. He was back in the early 1980s, he was the prize prospect of the Baltimore Orioles. He was going to be the next Frank Robinson. He came up at the end of the 1980 season, I believe it was, and we all raced over to see him play. He got 5 at-bats, struck out 4 times, and we never heard from him again. And it's easy to make jokes about him, but at the same time, when you get right down to it, a lot of us true baseball fans have been able to play 2 games in the major leagues, even if we only get 5 at-bats and strike out 4 times. Hey, I would have done it, and I suspect most fans would do
it. It's a dream come true.
Okay, so your contention is that the true baseball fan never grows up.
That's probably true, sure. And the true baseball fan probably has a name that's not quite as much fun as Drunko Hazel.
All right, Howard, one of your entries maintains that wearing a good luck shirt while watching a game on TV, especially if it's a good luck TV, actually works. How did you prove that, at least to your own satisfaction?
Well, the Red Sox won the 2004 World Series. They won it because I wore a Los Angeles Angels T-shirt during the entire playoff series and during the World Series. I sat in the same spot, and I watched on the same television every minute of every one of those games. And if you need more proof than that, then you really, I think, are beyond hope on that issue.
Right. And your law practice survived all this.
It did, yes.
To what extent was this book written as a kind of irreverent response to all the saberish tributes to statistics and their interpretation, the kind of over-seriousness embodied there?
I think that's really what was our impetus in the first place, was that I think both Howard and I were getting a little tired of hearing everybody always doing 2 things with baseball. One is either focusing so much on the statistics and creating new statistics to talk about baseball, so much so that you don't actually enjoy the game itself, or going to the taking it from another perspective, talking about how baseball is a metaphor for life and help us understand who we are as a people, and talking about it in those kind of terms that also seem to lose the fact that it's a fun game. Go watch. Hey, look, this guy just hit a home run. That guy just dove and caught a ball. It's, you know, either perspective, you'll lose the fun of the game.
You go along with this perspective, Howard, that baseball is in fact not a metaphor for life?
No. I disagree completely.
Excellent.
Baseball is actually and absolutely a metaphor for life.
You know, I hope Cal Ripken drives over to your home and kicks your rear end, Howard.
You know, I saw a fat, overweight guy in a Baltimore Orioles shirt and cleats the other day hanging outside my house. Did you give him my address?
No, but I will now, and I will to any Baltimore Orioles fans that happen to be listening. You can email me, and I'll send you Howard's address.
Michael, whole books have been written about the 8 members of the Chicago White Sox who were banned from baseball for conspiring to throw the 1919 World Series, but only in your book have I seen the contention that it's Kevin Costner's fault that Joe Jackson is not in the Hall of Fame. Did you get struck by this notion when you realized you guys just didn't have enough stuff for a book yet?
He's on to us, Mike.
not at all. I firmly believe that had Kevin Costner been able to continue his hot streak of movies back in the 1980s, people forget that back in the 1980s, at least, Kevin Costner was the biggest movie star alive. He had a couple of he was on a streak for a few years. But most importantly, he had the 2 big baseball movies that came out within 2 or 3 years of each other, Field of Dreams and Bull Durham. And with Field of Dreams in particular, and people have wildly different opinions of that movie. There are people that love it and felt like calling their fathers up afterwards, and other people that ran to the men's room to be sick. But based after that movie, Field of Dreams, because it was so popular and because Costner was so popular, there was a renewed debate as to whether or not Shoeless Joe Jackson should be allowed into the Hall of Fame, whether he should be reinstated into baseball. And it was a really vigorous, healthy debate about it. And the debate died when Kevin Costner made Waterworld. That was it. Had Kevin Costner made
Joe Jackson rolled in his grave and gave up again.
Had Kevin Costner made a few more movies, Joe Jackson might be in the Hall of Fame.
By the way, guys, I'm all for opinions, but your opinion that Honus Wagner was nicknamed Big Poison just doesn't cut it. And I think it's fair to point that out because fans are always writing the editors of the Baseball Encyclopedia with corrections, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I will tell you, that is a shameful mistake in our book for which the fact checker needs to be fired.
Not either of the authors.
Listening right now, I want that guy fired. And what Bill's talking about is we had there's a chapter in the book about nicknames and how there used to be some great, great nicknames, and they just aren't anymore. And unfortunately, the fact checker, in going through, changed the little section about Lloyd and Paul Wehner, who were known as Big Poison and Little Poison, to Honus Wagner and Lloyd Wagner.
Right.
I don't even know who Lloyd Wagner is. I think he used to be on the Carol Burnett Show.
No, he was actually Honus Wagner's brother, and he played 1 year in the big leagues, and his nickname, if I'm not mistaken, was Butts.
But he also was on the Carol Burnett Show.
And...
No, Howard, that was Lyle Wagner. That was Lyle Wagner.
Oh, Lyle Wagner, right. That's right.
And Bill, I'm going to tell you this, not many people remember this. On the Carol Burnett Show, Lyle Wagner and Tim Conway were known as Big Poison and Little Poison.
But, you know, you also might want to have that fact checker check into the authorship of Harrison Bergeron.
And I'm falling on my sword about that one. Just so your listeners know, there's a chapter of the book that deals with bases on balls, and I start off by telling a little story about a short story that we had to read back in high school. And I was so positive of the authorship of the story of Ray Bradbury that I never even took a second to look at it. And it ended up being the case, and as I now know, that it's actually one of my favorite authors, Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah, yeah.
And now, that fact checker, who still should be fired for
twice
for the Honus Wagner thing, I'm taking some of the responsibility on this one, but now I want him fired and I want to run out of town.
Howard Bloom is the co-author of the Baseball Encyclopedia, published by Emmis Books. He joined me here in the studio. Howard, thank you.
Thanks very much for having us.
And his co-author is Michael Kuhn, who spoke to us by phone from Los Angeles. Thank you, Michael.
Anytime, Bill. It's a pleasure.
You're listening to Only a Game. Carolyn Grun of Rockford, Illinois, emailed recently to thank the Only a Game Haiku players for their efforts on our pre-Super Bowl show. I'm a middle school language arts teacher with many hopeful football players now studying poetry. You've given me a great resource I know they'll enjoy, especially the last one about the coach's head. For the record, that would be silly coach screaming, the call stands, you change nothing, but your head explodes. But close enough for poetry, I guess, and hopeful football players now studying poetry may sustain me for weeks. Charles Mayhood of St. Albans, Vermont, was among the listeners impressed by Olympic athletes who were not promoted or profiled by U.S. television. Wow, he wrote, the Chinese silver medalists in pair skating were breathtaking. They are the first pair since Gordieva and Grinkov to bring true presence to the ice. They will dominate for years to come. From Bird Island, Minnesota, Tasha Montello emailed to say she finds Only a Game funny and soothing, but she heard a clinker in last week's program when Charlie Pierce mispronounced the town in Nebraska that should be pronounced Shadron and characterized as flat the surrounding area, which, Ms. Montello says, is, quote, actually quite hilly. Chuck Strins of Eagan, Minnesota, wrote to make the same correction. I hope somebody will email this week to tell us why so many people in Minnesota know so much about Nebraska. And finally, Jonathan Robinson, who hears the program on Vermont Public Radio, wrote to say that my conversation last week with Charlie about NASCAR handed him a laugh. You felt the need to insert a personal disclaimer, not wishing to offend any NASCAR fans who were tuning in, he wrote. Just how many NASCAR fans do you think listen to NPR? Well, we ran Mr. Robinson's assumption that there was little, if any, overlap between NASCAR fans and NPR listeners by Ann Peters, National Public Radio's senior analyst for audience and corporate research.
He's wrong, actually. I looked it up, and about 15% of our audience follows NASCAR, and that's just on television alone. If you total that out, that's about 3.8 million people.
Hey, Jonathan, I was surprised too. Should you wish to reach us, our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can also contact us through the website, onlyagame.org. Our mailing address is onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or you can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. By the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the blind wrestling the blind and the sighted. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
On Thursday, Japan's Shizuka Arakawa stole the Wheaties box right out from under Sasha Cohen by winning the ladies' figure skating gold medal. Do people in Japan even eat Wheaties?
The Pixies go off to Pixieland for another 4 years. Yeah, this was quite an upset, as was shown by the complete disbelief on the gold medalist's face. It was also, as has been mentioned by commentators who know more about figure skating than I do, a testimonial to the new scoring system, because Sasha Cohen, who finished second, fell twice, which apparently you can make up for now by skating better in the end of the program. But I have to say goodbye to Irina Slutskaya, who's skating with, you know, terrible. Her mother's sick back home. She's got vasculitis herself. I was actually sort of rooting for her.
This has been a great Olympics for athletes changing countries at the last minute. Tanith Belbin, a Canadian until about 7 weeks ago, helped bring the U.S. an ice dancing medal. And Lascelles Brown, a Jamaican until late January, was the brakeman on the Canadian bobsled team, and they won a silver medal. Now do Canada and Jamaica sue for partial credit, or maybe they get the little piece of silver that came out of the middle of those medals?
Well, actually, Canada has been doing this in the Summer Olympics for years and years, including Donovan Bailey and Ben Johnson. Excuse me. Ben Johnson.
The Jamaican, name out.
The Jamaican sprinter who, as we know, in his attempt to deceive the world, accidentally put on a Canadian uniform and won the 100 meters in Seoul and then had a bad drug test. But this is a good. I mean, this was a nice story. But Lascelles Brown's start times were way ahead of everybody else's, and as you said, maybe he gets the little piece in the middle of the CDs that they're giving out for medals.
That's right. The Olympics wouldn't be the Olympics, of course, without a doping scandal, and these Winter Games provided a dandy. Charlie, the president of the Austrian Ski Federation, has said, "quote I think they, in this case, the Italian police, are going too far." Do you agree?
Well, they certainly chased him all over the map. They had a high-speed chase in Austria, and Meyer wound up in the laughing academy of an Austrian hospital.
Said it was a dandy.
But, I mean, this is, Meyer said he gave athletes injections of blood infused with ultraviolet light as a preventive measure to ward off colds and other ailments.
And darkness.
Yes, he did. And then he went to the top of the mountain, and the little angels in their sparkling spaceships took them all to heaven.
Isaiah Thomas, upon whom we can always depend to wheel and deal and create some NBA trading excitement, did it again this week when he traded for Steve Francis. Can another New York Knicks dynasty be far off?
Now they have three guards who like to pound the ball on the perimeter and take their own shots. Isaiah Thomas, I mean, what is the great line from Michael Douglas in Wall Street? If this guy owned a funeral parlor, nobody would die. If Isaiah Thomas ran a hot dog stand out in front of his house, people would get botulism. This guy is the Don Budden of American business.
Now, there is a reference that I'm afraid will be lost on all but, baseball fans of a certain age.
Oh, they can all look it up. That's why the kids have this internet thing I'm so happy about.
The NBA trading deadline came and went on Thursday without any other blockbuster-type activity, unless Vitaly Potapenko and Earl Watson qualify as blockbuster-type players.
There were no blockbuster deals in the sense that there were no surprises, but Ron Artest was traded. Ricky Davis for Wally Szczerbiak, which may lead to the Boston Celtics eventually acquiring Kevin Garnett and thereby transferring the Minnesota Timberwolves' problems to the other side of the continent. Chris Wilcox was traded. Steve Francis were traded. These are some pretty high-profile players moving.
On Wednesday, 70-year-old Gene Best became the first college basketball coach to win 1,000 games. I guess now we can add Poplar Bluff to the list of hallowed basketball destinations, right?
Yes, he coached at Three Rivers Community College, and he did, in fact, coach Latrell Sprewell in the early 1990s when Latrell was kicking around before going to Alabama, and as you said, has managed to come out unscathed.
In Florida and Arizona, spring training is underway, unless you're Manny Ramirez, but do you agree with me that the week's most alarming baseball story involves retired catcher Darren Dalton?
Darren Dalton is an interesting character. He was the one who was in the car with Lenny Dykstra when they had the horrible automobile accident a decade or so ago and almost died. He's also the one whose ex-wife was a waitress at Hooters who was pictured on the center field wall of the Phillies training camp in Clearwater. But now, following in the footsteps of Steve Carlton, the Hall of Fame pitcher for the Phillies who didn't speak for 20 years, and when he finally did, we realized he was sort of on the planet Mars. Darren Dalton has now begun to understand a personal and kind of unique metaphysics. He describes this as being beyond the senses, living in different dimensions, being reincarnated, having out-of-body experiences, and experimenting with numerology. And yes, he will have a book coming out about it. Yeah. I think he and the Austrian ski coach should get together and share some ultraviolet light because they have to clear their heads a little bit.
Numbers of the ballplayers who would normally be playing meaningless spring training games will begin playing for their countries in the World Baseball Classic. Instead, the first round begins on Friday in Tokyo. To what extent do you think this event will catch on with the public in general and the U.S. public in particular?
I think the critical World Baseball Classic is going to be the third or fourth one. Just as when the NBA stars went to the Olympics, it was a great thing the first time, a good thing the second time, and it's gradually sort of its novelty is worn off. I think the kind of squabbling we've seen from people like Alex Rodriguez doesn't get this off to a promising start in this country. I think overseas it's going to be a monster.
Charlie, a lot of athletes, active and retired, have endorsed various fast foods and soft drinks, of course. How do you like the choice Oakland Raiders wide receiver Randy Moss has made regarding which product he'll represent?
Well, back in Kanawha City in West Virginia, he's decided to open some smoothie shops, that old smoothie. and apparently he's very fond of something called the Caribbean Blend, which has to do with peaches and strawberries, bananas, pineapples and oranges. And he's even named his dog after the smoothie company whose franchise he's picking up. I have no idea. Maybe the guy did a major in business administration at Marshall University. Maybe this is his future. That old smoothie.
The good news in the Netherlands is that Dutch darts players have been winning more international matches, but this story has a dark side, too.
The beginners are starting to play a lot of darts, and they're hurting each other. Now, rule number one.
Nothing more dangerous than a darts beginner.
And I realize this rule is honored more in the breach in places like pet game farms in Texas, don't shoot or throw at the other people. However, a spokeswoman for the Dutch darts organization pointed out that sometimes the biggest problem is poorly hung dartboards.
Yes.
Because sometimes they fall off the wall on your head.
And finally, Charlie, hockey games are frequently delayed by fights, but those fights are usually between people rather than people and bears. And I'm not talking about Bruins in this case either.
Well, there was a woman walking towards the Village Community Center and saw some children playing street hockey and saw a polar bear sizing up the competitors for what perhaps was a buffet lunch. She went over there. She started swatting the bear. The bear knocked her down. She kicked him. She got swatted again. She rolled over, and the bear moved toward her. And finally, a neighbor killed the bear in the middle of the street. This is the kind of stuff that doesn't happen in the NHL, although if it did, the ratings would be a lot higher.
Charlie Fierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He has been to Churchill, Canada, polar bear capital of the world, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill. I've never had one of those.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. There is a New York City high school with a decades-old reputation for developing talented wrestlers who also happen to be blind. Only a Game's John Kalish met up with the grapplers of the New York Institute for Special Education in the Bronx and filed this report.
Oh, since the beginning of the season.
That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, all right, yeah.
The wrestling team of the New York Institute for Special Education finishes practice on a weekday afternoon and gathers in the boys' locker room for a weigh-in. The tall, skinny kid with the crew cut is 16-year-old Carmine Rublowski.
What I have is something known as retinopathy of prematurity. It's retrolental fibroplasia. It's basically a proliferation of blood vessels into the retina, causing detachments due to an oversaturated oxygen atmosphere.
Straddling a bench in front of the lockers is Sean Chittick, an 11th grader who's only 14.
I got skipped up.
Chittick is 6'5" and weighs a mere 152 pounds.
I need some motivation to work out, because if I'm at home and I say I'm going to work out, I ain't really going to do it.
Chittick's teammate, 15-year-old Devin Bullock, is also in need of some motivation. He needs to drop a few pounds to make weight for an upcoming tournament. Like many of his blind teammates, Bullock has a weakness for ethnic cuisine.
I'm going to cut back on the Chinese food, drink more water, and hopefully see how far that gets me.
For 13 years, Jack Coogie coached the wrestling team here at the New York Institute for Special Education. He's still a recreation worker at the school, but retired as wrestling coach two seasons ago.
Most kids have played some kind of football, at least with their friends, so they have an idea of tackling somebody, which is similar to a leg takedown in wrestling. Our kids have no experience like this whatsoever. Most of them have never been on any kind of team. So the whole concept of being on a team and competing in front of people is a completely new experience to them. You know, most kids have played Little League, T-ball, whatever, itty-bitty basketball. They have some kind of background in sports. Our kids usually have absolutely none.
In December, this mostly African-American team opened their season against the Dalton School, an exclusive private school on Manhattan's Upper East Side. The normal starting position for a wrestling match in which opponents stand 3 feet apart is altered to accommodate the blind wrestlers. Opponents stand in the center of the mat facing each other with palms touching. If wrestlers separate during a period, the touch start is used to resume the match. Dalton wrestling coach Roy Samuelson says that as far as he's concerned, blind wrestlers have an obstacle to overcome when it comes to learning the moves and positions of the sport.
They're at a clear disadvantage, and I don't know how much it is while they wrestle. It's got to be more in the teaching. You know, once you're out there, you get a feel for position, and to me, getting to learn those positions first, that's got to be the hard part.
But referee Dick Young, who has officiated at these blind high school wrestling matches for 25 years, says that once the match is underway, lack of vision is not necessarily a disadvantage.
When a boy is blind, yes, you're right, he can't see the opponent, but once they're in contact, you know, he knows where he is at all times, and it's a matter of working and developing habits and not having to think about what to do, but reacting to what your opponent does automatically. And that's difficult for sighted boys, blind boys, deaf boys. So that's the hard part about wrestling.
Earl Haley, the new coach of the blind wrestling team at the New York Institute for Special Education, says his boys don't take to the mat with a chip on their shoulder.
They never give up. They always work hard, and they never complain. You know, they never complain and say, oh, the reason why I lost is because the kids have sight. No, no, no. They said, I lost because he was better than me, not because, you know, he can see.
It's a big thing for these guys to go out and compete, as our kids here do, against the sighted world, you know, and to beat them. It shows them they can do it in other things, too.
Former coach Jack Cookie has seen what being on the wrestling team does for the emotional well-being of these blind athletes.
I've seen kids who weren't terrific students become much better students once they got involved in this because I think it gave them self-confidence. Going out for job interviews, getting a summer job, I think it all plays off of this, you know. It's pretty much a childhood event for most kids is to play sports. Our kids don't get it until they get here. And they usually don't see it till high school, so it has a dramatic effect on some of them.
Wrestler Devon Bullock is a 2-year veteran of the wrestling squad who takes pride in his ability to do reversals, a difficult move in which a wrestler goes from the bottom position to the top. He agrees with that notion.
Oh, man, it just makes me feel like a better person. Especially when you're on the mat, you get the ambition, the motivation to just go out there and do your thing.
A couple of years ago, a student at the school named Stefan Mason did his thing all the way to the New York State Private School Championship for his weight class. The 5'11" high school student weighed 275 pounds. Mason came in second in the Mayor's Cup, a competition open to all schools, public and private, in New York City. By all accounts, the best wrestler on the current New York Institute of Special Education team is 17-year-old Daryl Austin. The 152-pound senior is also a sprinter on the blind high school's track team. Austin, who was described by the coach of another team as explosive, is undefeated this season and lost only one match last year.
I wanted to do it in college, but a lot of the schools that have college wrestling, it's kind of hard to get into.
You're planning to go to college?
Yeah.
What do you want to do?
I'm going to study business management, you know, marketing, real estate. You know, stuff that counts.
Daryl Austin and his fellow wrestlers at the New York Institute for Special Education have been doing what counts at the annual Eastern Athletic Association for the Blind wrestling tournament. The team has won the wrestling championship at the EAAB for the last 5 years in a row. At the New York State Private School Championship last Saturday, Austin came in third in the 147-pound weight class. His teammate Sean Chittick came in fourth in the 154-pound weight class. For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Gabrielle Scruggs. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about the Baseball Uncyclopedia, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from the Baseball Encyclopedia co-author Michael Kuhn, who places the Georgia Peach on a list of history's most nefarious characters.
You have to admit, Joseph Stalin was more evil than Ty Cobb. Ty Cobb is 10th, and, you know, he can be proud of that.
Doesn't Mr. Kuhn know about the Cobbist purges in Detroit? That ought to at least vault him above Pete Rose and probably Mark McGuire. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, continuing support of individual creativity with the announcement of new MacArthur Fellows on September 20th. This is NPR, National Public